This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Intro. The UN Refugee Agency warns renewed violence in Central African Republic is threatening thousands of civilian lives, forcing many to flee and destroying villages and camps for displaced people.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva. Details next also. South Africa's ruling African National Congress is holding a major policy conference ahead of the 2019 presidential election. And at least 10,000 migrants were rescued on the Mediterranean this week as they made their way to Europe. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story. The UN Refugee Agency warns a renewed violence in Central African Republic is threatening thousands of civilians, forcing many to flee and causing destruction in villages and camps for displaced people. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
United Nations officials describe a chaotic scene of attacks by rival warring groups in different parts of Central African Republic. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahecic tells VOA that violence has broken out near the capital Bangui, in central parts of the country, and close to the border with Democratic Republic of Congo.
It is of concern to us because it in many places affects the population that has been displaced already, most likely more than once. And these are the most vulnerable. And as you know, there is a plethora of armed groups within the CAR. This is very concerning that we have recorded this escalation of violence over the past days and weeks.
While clashes are going on between self-defense groups and other armed groups, the UNHCR says civilians and humanitarian workers also are being targeted. In Zemio, a town near the border of DRC, the agency says houses close to its office were burned down. It says more than 1,000 people fled their homes, and many refugees in a nearby camp returned to DRC in fear for their lives. Mehetic says clashes in the town of Brio were so violent that all 2,400 inhabitants of a camp for internally displaced people fled, leaving it empty.
Indiscriminate attacks in Bria have left some 136 people dead and 36 wounded, with 600 houses burned and additional 180 looted. These are conservative estimates. People fleeing the violence speak of having witnessed brutal attacks, killings, robberies, lootings, and kidnappings.
Mahecic says it has not been possible to assess the full extent of damage or displacement from the recent violence because of the dangers. The UNHCR reports more than 5 years of civil war in CAR has uprooted more than 500,000 people inside the country and sent nearly as many fleeing across borders. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Africa's ruling African National Congress is holding a major policy conference to set priorities and programs ahead of the 2019 presidential election. The talks are being overshadowed by political trouble haunting the ANC as President Jacob Zuma faces questions about his future. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The ANC says this six-day meeting is an opportunity for the party to change and strengthen its policies in its bid to continue its dominance. Those policies include ones that directly affect South Africans, many of whom say they have been denied the economic opportunities promised by the ANC when it swept to power in 1994. Meanwhile, questions linger about President Jacob Zuma, who faces a no-confidence vote in Parliament over his widely unpopular decision to fire a well-respected finance minister and reshuffle his cabinet. The political upheaval prompted a major ratings agency to downgrade the nation's sovereign credit rating, which has negatively impacted the economy. Calls for Zuma to resign have even come from some prominent members of his party, which has long prided itself for maintaining a unified front. At the conference opening on Friday, Zuma downplayed the controversy.
Many of us have controlled ourselves not to respond to these comrades, because we know them. Some of them are not as strong as they project themselves. We know them. But because we are keeping to the discipline of the organization, we are not engaging them in public, and we will never engage them.
This meeting precedes a major ANC political conference set for December, at which point the party will choose a new leader, effectively sidelining Zuma, a seasoned political player, until his term ends in 2019. That new leader is likely to become the country's next president, and he or she would have the authority to pardon Zuma over the 783 counts of corruption he's currently facing. Experts describe the situation as a showdown between Zuma's favorite for the job, his former wife, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, and Zuma's increasingly critical and outspoken deputy president, Cyril Ramaphosa. Political analyst Judith February says she expects some of the negotiations to take place in private.
Essentially, this policy conference will be a proxy for the December leadership battle, and there will be horse trading going on behind the scenes. There will be provinces, branches trying to influence the process. And so, actually, I think policy will end up taking a back seat, and that this really is about the politics.
Zuma's political troubles come as the country grapples with record unemployment, which stands at nearly 30%, and an economy in recession. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Also, following developments at the ANC meeting is reporter Delia Robertson, who is an expert on South African politics. From Johannesburg, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kepawa about the policy conference and the major political players.
Well, I think at the heart of this meeting is a very deep divide within the ranks of the ANC. And this is seen by some of the policy documents that have been put forward for discussion. A lot of them contain the kind of language that's been used for people who are fronting for the president and the Gupta family with whom he has very close ties. And on the other hand, behind closed doors and in the corridors and things, people are talking about the realities that the country is facing, the fact that South Africa is now in a recession, the fact that we are facing further downgrades by the ratings agencies. All of these things are being discussed at the conference. And also in December, as you know, the ANC will hold its elective conference. This is sort of the precursor to that, at which time Jacob Zuma must step aside as president of the ANC and they must elect new leadership.
Now let's talk about that possible new leadership. Who are the front runners?
Well, at the moment, I think it's safe to say that the deputy president of both the ANC and the country, Cyril Ramaphosa, is one of the front runners. Jacob Zuma's former wife, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, is being very vigorously promoted by some factions within the ANC. But her campaign doesn't seem to be gaining much traction, and in fact, maybe is losing a little bit of steam, perhaps. And then there's sort of outsiders. There's Matthews Posa, who used to be the ANC Treasurer General. He was the Premier of a province at one stage under Mbeki. He's also been a Member of Parliament. And he's quite a popular figure, but I don't think that he will garner as much support as Dlamini Zuma or Ramaphosa. And also, the Speaker of Parliament, Baleka Mbete, has also thrown her hat into the ring. But once again, there doesn't seem to be a great deal of support for her.
Now, in recent elections, we've seen some cracks in the ANC leadership. How solid is the ANC as a party going into the next presidential election?
I think it's extremely weakened, Joe. As I mentioned, it's fractured, and not only sort of down the middle. There's several fractures within the party. They did quite badly at the local government elections last year. And by all accounts, people who monitor these things and occasional polls that are done, they seem to be shedding support, significant support.
But is there any opposition party that can really take on the ANC at the presidential level?
I don't think by 2019, which is when the next general election will be held, I don't think by then any other party will be able to win a simple majority. I'd be surprised if the ANC wins a simple majority in 2019. So what we're looking at probably from 2019 onwards is some sort of coalition-based governing agreement that comes into being.
That's reporter Delia Robertson in Johannesburg. She spoke to VOA's Jody Kapua. You were listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Fifteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The UN Refugee Agency warns renewed violence in Central African Republic is threatening thousands of civilian lives. And South Africa's ruling African National Congress is holding a major policy conference ahead of the 2019 presidential election. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. At least 10,000 migrants were rescued on the Mediterranean this week as they made their way to Europe. Most were taken to Italy, which is now threatening to block new arrivals if other countries do not do more to help. So far this year, nearly 96,000 migrants and refugees have entered Europe by sea. More than 2,100 have died trying to make the journey. But while sea rescues continue, so do migrant rescues in Niger's desert. The International Organization for Migration says 600 migrants from West Africa have been rescued since April. They were abandoned by smugglers during the journey to Libya. Not all are saved. However, more than 50 migrants who went missing last week after being left in the desert are believed dead. During his presidential campaign, Donald Trump promoted a nationalist America First approach to foreign policy. But in the months since taking office, he appears to have softened some positions for nations in the Middle East and North Africa. A panel of experts at the Brookings Institution discussed U.S. foreign policy and how the Trump administration might deal with critical issues over the next 4 years. Shibli Telami is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi about whether promoting democracy is a Trump administration priority.
Overall, the United States has never in its modern history made democracy a top priority in its foreign policy in the Middle East. It's been a rhetorical priority, particularly under George W. Bush, and obviously it's mentioned. It's not America doesn't care about this issue. It's not that America doesn't care about human rights. It does, and the American people do. It is that because America is strategically involved in the region, because it has troops in the region, because it's been fighting wars in the region, because it has a broader strategic interest, those broader strategic interests work often against the support for democracy. And, you know, you can argue that when the rhetoric was such that we pretended that democracy was a priority was problematic, because then we see the contradiction. People in the region see the contradiction. They don't believe it. So in some ways, the fact that Trump is not even bringing it up isn't substantially different in practice from what other administrations have done in practice.
Would congressional support for human rights and American values collide with the president's focus on counterterrorism in the area?
It has always conflicted with that, for sure, in my own opinion. I think the only question you ask, I mean, among analysts or people who think about this, is whether you can make an argument that if you focus only on counterterrorism as a strategy or military strategy, you are going to ultimately undermine the proliferation of democracy, because you're going to get more extremism and you're going to be tied more to dictators in fighting terrorism, and therefore you're going to undermine it. So you have to have a broader long-term strategy where you are maybe supporting your allies in the short term but also working towards something long-term. Theoretically, that's possible and even advisable. In practice, American presidents have short memories and short attention spans, and frankly, it's hard to sustain over time. And you have a new president, and they undermine the priorities of the previous president. They have their own priorities. So we have not had, as the United States of America, a consistent policy on those issues, and we're not likely to in any foreseeable future.
Final question. What parameters would shape President Trump's policy in Libya?
I don't know what parameters shape any policy, or whether you could call anything he's doing a policy, because frankly, he seems to act on his own, often maybe with very few advisors around him, sometimes without even consulting national security bureaucracies. And so even on issues that he thinks are important to him, like Syria or launching the attack on Assad. So on a question like Libya, which is more not in his top priority, except sees it as a counterterrorism conflict, he's more likely to listen to his allies on that, particularly the Egyptians, because they're next door.
That was Shebly Telami, Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. In many countries, including some in Africa, harsh anti-homosexual laws have been passed. Many carry long prison terms for convictions. But here in the United States and other Western nations, it's much different. For example, last week was Pride Week in New York City. It's an annual festival celebrating gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender, or LGBT, culture and community in the city and around the world. VOA's Adam Phillips was there for Pride's final events on Sunday and filed this report.
It's a sun-drenched afternoon, and Manhattan's West Village neighborhood is festooned with rainbow regalia, the colors of the gay pride flag. Tens of thousands of people have just completed the 48th annual Gay Pride March, and many are headed here to Pride Fest, a massive LGBT street fair. With her own rainbow cape and exuberant smile, an African-American lesbian named Rain seems to embody the day's proud spirit.
I'm here because I am out and proud. Yes, sir. Just happy to be me and blessed to be me, and I'm going to live the way I want, no matter what anybody else has to say about it.
Were you always so confident?
Yes, because I have loving parents that accepted me from the age of 13 when I told them.
But Rain's experiences outside her family are not always easy. She's often stereotyped at her job.
I work with kids, and when you find out, oh, well, she's gay, their first thought is sometimes, oh, maybe I don't want my kid around that. I don't want my kid to learn this. But it's not like I'm going around going, hey, you're going to be gay when you get older. No, be accepting of who you are and be happy about it, whether you're gay, straight, black, white, or whatever.
That can be easier said than done. Some at the Pride Fest have struggled to reconcile their sexual orientation with their upbringing and identity. Johnson Lee is with Grafted NYC, a gay Christian group.
I grew up in a conservative Christian household. Both my parents were actually ministers, and I was always taught that being gay was sinful, that being gay would go to hell. I really had to struggle with that and learn how to reconcile the two parts of my identity. And it took me a long time. It took me over a decade to really come to terms with it and realize that I can live and be both.
So what was the moment when you actually told your parents?
So I told them 2 years ago. I waited till Christmas. They had no idea, even though I was dropping hints for years. Hey, you know, I'm not really interested in girls. And to be honest, we're still going through it. We're still trying to figure it out. But at least now they know.
30-year-old Matthew Cornett had a very different experience growing up gay.
Yeah, I grew up with drag queens and gay people everywhere around me. So I grew up in a very open family, hippie family. And, like, I came from Irish immigrants. And, you know, they came here to make something. And then they made me. And they were just like, hey, just do you. So I lived life.
You know, there are a lot of people in the world who can't live that way.
Exactly, I know, and it's terrible that people didn't get to grow up the way I did.
When Joseph Davis came out, that is, openly revealed he was gay, to the tight African-American community where he grew up, he was shunned by some, embraced by others. Davis says he's glad he's now in Manhattan's Greenwich Village, the historic epicenter of the Big Apple's unabashed LGBT world.
Being LGBT in New York is liberating because, like, this is a space where we celebrate LGBT culture and we acknowledge LGBT culture. And it wasn't always the case, right? It took a lot of fighting. It took a lot of marching. It took a lot of protesting for us to get to a point where we can be able to be accepted for our full selves.
Now, what about your brothers and sisters in Africa? You know, you can get jailed or killed over there.
Right. I know that that happens to them. I think that the fight has to continue to go on in Africa. I know there's a lot of homophobia, especially in Uganda. I think that for my brothers and sisters in Africa to stay strong and to know that they are loved over here. Like, we love them, we see them, and we would do anything to support them as much as we possibly can.
Nearby, Rich Kiampo knows what it's like to grow up gay and in fear.
I can't speak to the African experience. I can speak to being in a small town in Illinois where people would throw, you know, rocks through my window and spray paint faggot at my house. And that's in America. I had dreams of, like, either a fireman or Superman coming to rescue me. So it's great to be here in New York. When I first came to New York, I felt like I exploded. Like, I can't believe this is so free.
In addition to NYC Pride, there are hundreds of other gay pride marches and related LGBT events throughout the U.S. and the world, including in Africa. Most are held in June, and all express the same hybrid spirit of protest, celebration, and community. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Vasco Volarej, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Watch out for the hottest music and music news from across the continent this Sunday. Hear the fascinating story and music of Papillon from Kenya. Find out who's headlining Canada's Nuit d'Afrique Festival in Montreal. Discover new and old music, too, from across the continent. Ever heard of the Malawi Mouse Boys? How about Songhoi Blues or Neba Solo? Gangbe Brass Band? Well, get hip to it all, peeps. Tune in, Music Time in Africa, this Sunday and the following Saturday at 15 and 2000 UTC. Oh, yeah.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.